I am from beyond. Listen, and all you desire will be yours. Welcome to Spider-Dan and the Secret Wars. Prepare for battle.
Shockphobia Fest!
Welcome to Prattle World. I am your host, the ever-amazing, ever-spectacular Spider-Dan. And in this podcast, I spotlight entertainment's best-kept secrets that a mainstream audience may find boring. And welcome to Shockphobia Fest, a month-long celebration of All Hallows' Eve most frightening films and comic spooks. And since this has been the longest year on record, my guest wants to talk about Batman's longest year. Welcome back, Daniel Keatis.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be back on Prattle World. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Thank you again for being my guest. It's been since Christmas since I had your last.
It has been a long time. The last time we talked, it was about, was it Batman and the Outsiders?
It was Batman.
Goodness gracious. So we're back in the same sort of realm.
Same sort of wheelhouse.
And I always feel marginally guilty when we talk about Batman because it's not exactly a best-kept secret of entertainment media, especially with Warner Brothers, like, very, very reticent to venture outside of Batman and his sort of ancillary characters.
That is true.
But I think I wanted to talk about this book because it's something that means a great deal to me, and it's something that has had, I think, even if you've never read this book, you will recognize where it's been referenced. Certain panels have been referenced in certain things. I'm thinking mostly the rooftop scene in The Dark Knight between Batman, Commissioner Gordon, and Harvey Dent is directly pulled from this book, and just the whole sort of very noirish murder mystery aspect of it. It seems to be a very big part of, I was going to say next year's The Batman, but
yes.
It's been bumped to March 2022 now.
No.
Which is, COVID really is the gift that keeps on taking. So
yes, well, this is, like I said, this has been a very long year, and this is, of course, we're talking about Batman, The Long Halloween. So this is a big kind of seminal book, a spiritual sequel, if not direct sequel, to Year One, Batman Year One. There was a comic book called Year Two, and there was a Batman Year Three as well, but they're kind of...
We don't talk about those.
Yeah, we kind of want to forget them. They're not. I mean, there's some interesting stuff in them, don't get me wrong.
Have you read Year Two or Three?
I have read Year Two. I've not read Year Three.
It's one of those, I kept meaning to pick it up, and it was never sort of a price point that was affordable for me. And then the longer I left it, the less interested I seemed in revisiting it. But yeah, from what I understand, it was like a big part of it was why Batman doesn't use a gun. Like, he started out using one, or flirting with the idea of using one, but something happens in that book that makes him...
Yeah, if I remember rightly, it's been a while. I think I do have it somewhere. I do own it. It's got some great Todd McFarlane covers as well and artwork, but he doesn't do all of the issues. I think Alan Davis comes on and does the rest of the work. But it's kind of about him confronting Joe Chill.
Okay.
About the killing of his parents, and he's kept the gun.
Oh, right. Okay.
So he carries the gun that killed his parents, and he's going to kill Joe Chill with it. That's why he's running around with a gun and most of the covers, controversially.
Yeah, yeah.
But it turns out that there is a new vigilante called the Reaper who inspired the Phantasm from the animated movie, and he has to team up to stop the Reaper, team up with Joe Chill, the killer of his parents, to stop this character. So there's some interesting elements, but I don't think it's the best kind of thought out and direct sequel to Year One, with Year One being like the classic, it's just hailed as one of the best, if not the best, Batman story of all time. I think this is so much closer to being in tone and character-wise and the world changes with this book. I think the world of Gotham specifically changes from these kind of pinstripe suit classic gangsters, you know, the criminal element, to the kind of freaks of Gotham, the Arkham Asylum inmates, the Mad Hatters and Scarecrows of the world. This kind of opens that door. And it even says in the book that it kind of goes, you know, we see a lot more of these weirdos now that you've come around. So it's almost like Batman is the magnet for the madness. There's kind of a touchstone for all the crazy in the world.
Well, I mean, it starts off direct, like the first page is directly referencing The Godfather, where you've got Bruce Wayne with his hat in his hand saying, I believe in Gotham City, is directly referencing that sort of I believe in America monologue from the opening of The Godfather. What is so wonderful to me about this book is it speaks very much to my sort of Batman sensibilities, but it also kind of informs them as well. Hmm. So I first picked this book up. I'm holding it right now in my hands, actually. This is the Bible. Ever so slightly worn, ever so slightly foxed copy of Batman the Long Halloween, I purchased in, I think, it would have been the summer of 1999. And I bought it at a place called the Trafford Centre, which if you live in the Greater Manchester area or in the Northwest, you'll know of it. It's obviously lots of little shops have come and gone through there over the years. And a lot of the smaller ones that couldn't afford to be there now. When it first opened, there were quite a few. There was like a little sort of almost like a marketplace bit where you had these little independent stores. And there was one called The Last Picture Show, which was kind of like a mini Forbidden Planet, I guess.
Yeah, it was very kind of cult movie memorabilia.
There were little bits here and there, little bits of collectibles, the odd action figure thrown in here and there. And there was some, you know, like you get the film cells that you mount on the wall. There was a lot of them. And they had a modest selection of graphic novels. And at the time, so I would have been about 16, 17. And at the time, I remember I mostly used to get monthly comics from a little stall in Lee Market, where I grew up. It's a shithole.
you and I have that in common.
there was a little stall in the market, a little used bookseller, and he had just a box of comics. And it was, you know, 25p each, five for a pound. So me and my mate, we'd go through and we'd dig through. And you'd never get any sort of continuity from one issue. No. You could never follow a story. So I remember, I think I got some George Perez and Marv Wolfman Teen Titans. Like loads and loads of issues apart. So I I got some sort of like just after the death of Superman where he had the big long mullet.
Oh yeah.
I got some of those issues. I got some really nice, post Nightfall issues of Batman, you know, where Kelly Jones took over on the artwork. Ooh, and it got very, very dark and expressionistic.
Very nice.
That was a big part of like shaping what I look for in a Batman story when I was a kid. And there was also some of the Norm Breyfogel Batman stuff.
One of my favorite Batman artists.
And I remember there was a very, very one of my favorite issues was one where he battles Etrigan the Demon.
Oh yeah. And, I bet that'd be great.
It was the one where sort of like Etrigan choking life out of him and he's like, I've got to do something. And he hits him as hard as he can with all he's got. And he's like, no, that's like punching a rock. And Etrigan's just kind of like, he's taken aback by it. And he's like, I do believe I'll laugh. And he just starts cackling manically. And he's like, oh, I like this guy. And I remember his like parting shot to him is like, I'll take comfort in knowing that I'm not the only demon lurking in a man's body.
Nice.
when he takes his leave. Cool. Yeah. But obviously he says it in much more poetic sort of verse than I'm doing right now.
Being a rhyming demon.
Yeah, exactly. but back to Long Halloween. So I saw this book and I was flicking through it and it just absolutely spoke to my sense. Like the expressionistic nature of Tim Sale's art. I loved how sort of huge and monolithic Batman looked. I love what he did with Gotham City. As someone who grew up watching Tim Burton's Batman films, and they mean a lot to me. So I really loved how expressionistic and noir-esque Gotham looked. I loved what he did with the use of shadows. Mm. I loved the muted color palette. Wasn't like anything I'd seen in comics before because I was reading, you know, just monthlies from the 80s and early 90s. And so I didn't catch this as it was coming out. I think I was a little bit young to be following, well, not young, but like, it wasn't, the comics landscape wasn't the same as it is today. You know, no. you couldn't pick up your monthlies the day they came out on Comixology. You know, you were sort of beholden to what you could get from your local news agents as well, especially in like a little small town.
Yeah, exactly.
So I remember flicking through this book and absolutely falling in love. And I think, you know, it's 12 issues, so it was a big, hefty, I thought, oh, it's a big, hefty book, and it's about the same price as all the others, so I'm getting more value for money here. And flicking through it, it looks like it's my sort of jam, you know, in terms of like what I expect from a Batman story. And I'm flicking through and I'm seeing, wow, Joker's in this one. Wow, Riddler's in it. Wow, you've got Scarecrow here and there. And you've got all these cool gangster types. And this, I hadn't actually read Year One at this point. So this was actually the prelude was my gateway into not only Year One, but The Dark Knight Returns.
Wow.
Because there's a foreword in it by...
I think it's Jeff Loeb, I think.
It is Jeff Loeb, yeah. That's right, yeah. So Jeff Loeb's got a little forward in there where he talks about sort of wanting to... Archie Goodwin, who was editing, I believe, Batman at the time.
What a legend.
Yeah, the legend that is Archie Goodwin. He was saying to them in a meeting about how Frank Miller doesn't appear to want to revisit the Year One sort of characters. And I really like what you guys do with film noir. So would you like to do a sort of film noir-inspired Batman murder mystery? And which ended up being The Long Halloween. And so I was like, what's this Batman Year One? What? And then it said, what? And it says, while Year One isn't the classic that is The Dark Knight Returns. I'm like, what's this Dark Knight Returns?
Mm.
So I ended up checking out these very seminal Batman books as a result of picking up this.
This is a seminal Batman book. It's got to go up there with those, I believe. Like my humble opinion, I don't know if everyone else will agree, but I think it is one of those strong Batman stories. And I think it's got some of the best elements I find in Batman stories, that it's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of set early in his career. He's a fallible human being. He makes mistakes. He's not the world's greatest detective yet. You know, he's got somewhere to go, and that the landscape of Gotham is not necessarily what you expect it to be.
Yeah.
And the challenge, he hasn't come up against those kind of big challenges. Those, you know, he's not taken on all the Bat family, whether you like them or not. You know, there's those kind of elements. So I always like that. That's why I used to love the Legends of the Dark Knight series that has like Venom in there and Shaman and loads of other great stories, because they're usually kind of set around that era, kind of quite early on in his career, and kind of introduce a lot of the kind of villains and stuff. So I've always kind of enjoyed those kind of Batman stories, especially like being a massive fan of Batman the Animated Series.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Like there's a lot. I feel there's a lot of that in this, and I think they probably took some of that inspiration as well. Tim Sale's style is almost more like a cartoonist, I think. Almost it's not realistic. It's not a realistic.
It's not an
Alex Ross. But there's this energy to it, and this dynamism, and this, and also like you were saying, the stillness and the use of the color and stuff. Interesting fact: Tim Sale is actually colorblind.
I remember you telling me that a long time ago. Yeah, yeah. I think that's really cool. I mean, I'm assuming that he wasn't the inker on this.
I imagine he just did
pencils on this. In fact, I'm so sorry. Inkers of the world, I apologize. It was Jeffrey Wright who was the inker on these issues.
And what a great job he does. Like, it's incredible. And every splash page you could mount on your wall, like I'd mount them on my wall quite happily. Just gorgeous, gorgeous work.
Well, there are a lot of, just a heads up, we're not going to get into spoiler territory. We're also not going to talk ever so much about the plot.
No, not really.
Because if you're a Batman fan, you've probably read this anyway. And if this book has somehow eluded you, but you're sort of aware of its reputation, we wouldn't want to deprive you of the gift of discovering the main sort of story beats for yourself. And if it's
going to be integral kind of story elements from the new film, we could potentially be spoiling the film as well.
Yeah, which it very much could be. I mean, just to go off on a little mini tangent, as you know, I was a little bit resistant to what became the Batman, mostly because sort of, you know, I know that there are a lot of Batman fans who like Batman to be very much in his own sandbox and build out from that, if you will, but like keep him away from the Justice League.
Yeah.
But having grown up with having seen a lot of that, I was ready to see Batman sort of mixing up with Superman and Wonder Woman and The Flash. And as you know, I am much more DCEU positive than many. But I was very much sort of when Ben Affleck sort of took a step back from playing Batman. It's nice to see he's coming back now, but that's a whole other podcast. I was kind of, my sort of enthusiasm for the project kind of dropped off from there. And then when they started looking for a younger Batman, I just thought, oh, okay, so this could be a prequel because you've got 20 years worth of Batman stories to tell in that universe. That's cool. And then when we found out that Matt Reeves wanted to do his own thing and not be beholden to the sort of DC films canon, I thought, is it really the best idea to have Batman in his own little pocket universe? Well, we'll see. But like the more I found out, the more I thought, well, isn't this going to be sort of like Nolan Dark Knight trilogy 2.0? And my enthusiasm kind of waned a little bit. But when that first teaser came out, the DC fandom teaser, the feel of it very much so took me to how I felt when I was first reading this book, The Long Halloween, and this sort of the whimsical, quite ominous atmosphere that it manages to create. And there's kind of a visual richness to it as well. And it's got elements of noir and kind of elements of psychological thriller. And I thought, okay, yeah, this is I'll put my slippers on and put my feet under the table because I'm home, you know, in terms of my Batman sensibilities.
It's definitely a very kind of, there's a lot of like, this is not like, again, like, comics are absolutely not always for children, you know. No. And I think this one is not one you would give to a child to go, here you go, Batman. You know, this is deep, dark, rich, textured storytelling.
I'd give it to like maybe a precocious 11 or 12 year old.
Yeah,
I'd
probably.
Say.
Yeah.
I'd say that like you wouldn't give it to your 7 year old, I'd say. No. I think this is if your Batman sensibilities are shaped by this book, as mine were, you're in a good place. You know, I think read this and you'll know what you want from a good Batman story.
I think so. I think you are absolutely right. I will talk about the plot in the barest sense that we can.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just going to be like a little synopsis. But basically, it's effectively year two of Batman's career. We've had year one. It's kind of coming off the back of that. There is a crime boss known as Carmine Falcone, or Falcone, however you want to pronounce it, the Roman Empire. So he's very much like a kind of a Mario Puzo-esque Godfather type figure. And, you know, it opens very much like The Godfather on the wedding day. You come to me on the day of my daughter's wedding. You know, all that sort of stuff.
That was very good.
I do try. I was an actor. and there's even that scene later with one of the other bosses where he's like picking oranges.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, the Maronis, one of the Maronis picking oranges and then get shot. But yeah, so that's the... So they decide Gordon, Batman, bring Harvey Dent in because they think he's the best guy to help bring down this criminal empire. And they very tentatively team up. And throughout the book, what I really like is that they slowly begin not to trust each other as much because they don't know what's going on, who's doing what, could it be one of them potentially doing what happens within the book. So there are a series of murders that are planned and take place on holidays. So the first one is Halloween, and then a holiday every month until the following Halloween where the story resolves. And it is, they nickname the killer Holiday, and they uses a small 22 pistol with a kind of the bottle of a baby's...
The nipple of a baby bottle, yeah.
Yeah, nipple of a baby bottle as a silencer. And they always leave a little knick-knack, like St. Patrick's Day, there's a little leprechaun and a pumpkin.
Cornucopia for Thanksgiving. Pumpkin for Halloween.
Yeah.
There's some good ones as well. There's I think it's a tie for Father's Day, which I thought was kind of cute.
Yeah, that's great. I love that, actually. I thought it was really good.
Box of chocolates for Valentine's Day.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You see the fireworks, I think, in the background for 4th of July.
Yes.
So there's quite a few kind of elements of that. So the whole story is about them trying to solve
who the holiday killer is, while also trying to bring Falcone down and seeing the lengths they have to go to and what they're going to have to be kind of guilty of, potentially, criminal actions, potentially. But they're trying to do it within the law where they can. That's the basic premise, I think.
Yeah.
And then obviously you get all the kind of crazy kind of Catwoman, Joker, all these kind of characters come forward.
Yeah, there's a lot of Batman's rogues gallery kind of just weave in and out of the story. And what I like is, even though some of them are in there quite tangentially, they never feel like they're forced in. Like even the Joker, who works best when he doesn't really have an agenda, he's just kind of like a weapon of mass destruction. I think that his reason for being there is quite fitting. And I love the way Tim Sale draws the Joker as well. This incredibly sort of expressionistic with the huge smile and the huge pointy chin and the
millions of
French fry teeth. Yeah.
I was going to say, I do like a lot of the designs for the Rogues Gallery. I'm a big, like, Scarecrow is like my favorite Batman villain. I love that he's got like the kind of the stick in the back.
Yes.
It's all black, and he's got this kind of big, almost like crow-like nose across the mask. Very gaunt figure. He's got horrible nails and fingerless gloves. I think the only design, the redesign I don't really like is the Penguin.
See, I like the Penguin because that's because I like my Danny DeVito, Tim Burton kind of Penguin. Him to flippers and
bit freaky.
Yeah. And but he's not in this very much. He's in the sequel more.
It's just the very big mouth he has and the tiny, tiny teeth.
Yeah. I quite like that. That's my jam.
Well, that's not... I disagree. Horrifically disagree. I think there is always like designs of characters and everything's up to artistic interpretation. But
that particular
one, I don't particularly like. But all the other ones I love. I really like that they include Solomon Grundy in this as well.
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to get into specifics, I think Solomon Grundy is responsible for one of my favourite little moments, and I apologise. This is kind of, it's not really a plot spoiler, but it's just a special little moment where so Batman and Solomon Grundy have this big fight, and then towards the end of the issue, Solomon Grundy's been lurking in the sewers, and at the end of the issue, you see because it's Thanksgiving, or is it? No, it's Christmas. It's Christmas Day, and Batman leaves a little sort of like plate of Christmas roast for Solomon Grundy, and you just see him leave the little plate and then leave it, and then you just see Solomon Grundy sort of like his arm come into frame. And take a little chicken drummer, and that charmed me because I thought, you know, he can beat the living shit out of a guy, but also, you know, recognize that he's got issues and he wants to have a nice meal on Christmas Day.
And I think he understands, like Batman understands what who the true monsters are, and he's kind of just misunderstood, very much like a Bizarro type.
Yeah, he didn't ask to be what he is, did he? Solomon Grundy. Exactly.
And there's another moment again, which kind of another one of my favorite moments as well in the book, but it's between him and Harvey Dent. Later on in the book, when they kind of bump into each other. I don't want to spoil it, but they bump into each other and they have a kind of similar kind of almost like, oh, you're a bit like me, aren't you? You're similar to me. You know, and they both kind of sit down and have each other's company. There's no kind of violence or anything. So I always enjoy kind of the lesser known characters popping up as well. Speaking of lesser known characters, I love the reinterpretation of the Calendar Man.
Yeah, that is because he was very much sort of Golden Age.
I think maybe silver to bronze. Yeah, I think silver to bronze. I read a Len Wein story where he dresses up as something different because he never really had a set. A lot of people remember him wearing the big calendar, the red and white thing, but he didn't actually wear that very often. He would dress like one Walt Simonson story I read, he would dress up like Odin.
Okay.
And then dress up like Thor, and it was based on like the days of the week and stuff like that and why they were named certain things. So he would always have like a slightly different outfit, which I thought was kind of cool. He's kind of turned in this, and this is like the constant interpretation for this character now since this book. You play the Arkham games, Calendar Man's in there, and he's portrayed just like
exact
this.
Same aesthetic, exact same sort of exact. He's in the exact same place as well.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true.
He's not moved. He's still locked up.
And I remember if you visited him on a holiday, he would say something related to that holiday.
Because I remember at the time I really wanted to get all the trophies on my Xbox 360, so I remember just going in and changing all the dates and logging back into the game and visiting him I think 12 times. Happy times.
Good
happy
times. Good game.
Very good game. But yeah, he's very much sort of you like the same presence and the same plot function as Hannibal Lecter in this story. And there's a similar moment, which I really, really like, where you've got Batman and the Riddler both trying to figure out who Holiday is. At the same time, but where Batman's sort of like working quietly and diligently, the Riddler's kind of being all flamboyant and showing off and trying to sort of like weave through, oh, it could be this person, it could be that person, and just not really, because he's commissioned by Carmine Falcone to find out who Holiday is. And
I think that's one of my favourite issues in the whole book, because the Riddler is known for his intelligence and he's known for being able to figure stuff out and, you know, put the puzzles and uncover them and things like that. And even Batman's teamed up with him from time to time because that's a skill that he can kind of use.
Yeah.
But in this particular month is April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
And I love that even the Riddler can't figure it out. All of his guesses, like even when he's talking to Carmine, he's like, who is it? And he's like, it could be this person, it could be that person, but what about this person? And then he even goes to Carmine, who's like, oh, you know, Carmine is the Holiday, and he starts laughing. He's like, you're an idiot. Sends him out, shoves him out the door. Or Sophia Gigante Falcone, or Falcone Gigante as she's called between issues, so whoever, whatever her name is, who knows, it's one way or the other. She pushes out the door, and then Holiday appears and goes to shoot him and doesn't shoot him because it's April Fool's Day.
And that charmed me.
I think that was a really good idea, because again, he's a fool because he can't figure it out, this big brain can't figure it out, but he's also April Fool's. You expect something to happen, but the joke is, you know, I kind of expected like the Joker to be on April Fool's Day just because of it being April Fool's Day. But I really loved that issue. I thought it was a really clever idea. And yeah, I thought it was a great ending to that particular issue. But it's, again, all good stuff. But that one, that really touched me in the right way. Not in a dirty way, just the right way.
So how did you come to this story then? Did you pick it up as individual issues? Because you would have been quite young when this came out. I think it was 96, 97?
Yeah, so I didn't read it until... So I've always been a bit of a Marvel kid, as you know. And I think as I was kind of getting back, I kind of dropped comics for quite a while and got quite into wrestling.
Wrestling.
And trying to, you know, get with girls and stuff. Because that's what you do as a teenager. And it's like, girls don't like comics and action figures, so get rid of them. So that's what I thought. I thought, that'll do it. To my surprise, it was not the case. So I got back into comics. I was reading kind of Spider-Man, X-Men again.
Yeah.
Read some kind of Marvel horror titles. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to branch out. I'm a bit bored. I'm going to branch out. So I've done all the Spider-Man, X-Men, Marvel stuff. So I started reading things like Moon Knight, Iron Fist, kind of lesser known characters and stuff I'd never really would have read. So eventually I was like, okay, let's do Batman. I know it's an obvious one, but let's kind of do Batman. And I did Year One, did Dark Knight Returns, did all the other ones. And I think I did a few of the ones that were available in my local comic book shop, which was called Thunder Books. And it had the kind of insignia and logo of Thunderbirds.
Nice.
So I think it's called Infinity Comics now, if it's still going.
Okay.
I guess they're trying to, you know, plug into the kind of the zeitgeist at the moment, or the Infinity saga.
Fair enough.
Which is fine. So I asked it. I actually requested them to order it in, which was I did that with a few books, but they never told me it came.
Oh, what?
They never told me it got there.
So you had it waiting for you, all sort of gathering
so,
dust.
When I was like, they've never told me about this, so I'm guessing it never came in. I rocked up, and what do I find on the shelf? The same one I ordered.
Oh, what?
So I was like, well, I didn't mention it because I was like, the guy's nice. I was just like, you know what? I'll just buy it. It's here now. I'm just going to buy it. So I bought the same book.
Yeah.
I rebought it for, because I don't have it on me in my house currently. So I rebought it again on Comixology to read.
Okay.
So glad I did. But yeah, I loved it. I think it's great. I think it's, again, it's one of these great stories. It's nice. It's a proper epic.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to the 2-part animated film that they're going to bring out as well, I think.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see what it's going to look like, because as much as I did enjoy the sort of interconnected DC animated films that they did, I think, post Justice League War, and I can't remember when that came out, maybe 2013, 2012? Yeah. That sounds about right.
Kind of did this new 52 linked universe kind of stuff.
And as much as I hated the costumes, I liked the films.
Yeah.
And that sort of ended with that Justice League Dark, was it Dark Side War or Apocalypse War?
I'm going to say Apocalypse War.
Apocalypse War, yeah, that sounds right, which I still haven't seen yet. But
oh, it's really good. I highly recommend it.
I do intend to sort of like go through them all, and because I've still got this enormous box set of DC animated films from Superman... what's that?
Doomsday?
Doomsday, yeah. Superman Doomsday onwards. And that goes right up to the Batman Harley Quinn animated film.
Oh, quite. So quite fairly recent.
Yeah. And then I've got a bunch sort of after that. So I do intend at some point to go through those. Mm. Sorry, massive tangent.
No. But we love our tangents.
It's going to be really interesting to see, now that they're no longer beholden to that model, what they do with... so they can basically create an aesthetic from the ground up with every individual film, which I think works in their favour.
I personally preferred that. I didn't like the new 52 style, much like yourself. Mm. I didn't like that look to the characters. And I also quite like them getting different voice actors in.
Yeah.
Because I think that gives everybody an opportunity to play Batman, to play Wonder Woman, you know, all those kind of characters. And it makes every film feel a bit more unique.
Yeah.
That's why I like Gotham by Gaslight and Red Sun, because again, they broke away from that new 52 aesthetic. But I do get what they were trying to do, the linked universe, linked stories.
Yeah.
You know, the same voice actors, there's a bit of kind of continuity there.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate that. And again, if you watch Apocalypse War, you'll see a lot of like winks and nods to the previous movies.
Okay.
Cool. So it's really, really fun. A lot of my friends that I've spoken to have really enjoyed it and highly recommend it.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. I will pick it up. There's a bunch of the latter ones that they did a Hush one as well, which is same writer as Batman Long Halloween, different illustrator, obviously very much Jim Lee.
Yeah.
But that's I think gets, I think especially among younger fans, that is held up as sort of like the seminal one. But I think for my money, The Long Halloween is far superior book to Hush.
Yeah.
I like Hush.
I really like Hush.
And
as
I think that there are some similarities in terms of sort of like it's a mystery and that pulls in
all
Batman's
the characters,
rogues gallery here and there. And it's got Superman popping up in it, which always gets a vote from me. And to go off on another tangent, I really love the Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale Superman, Superman for All Seasons.
Yes.
That's it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm getting really forgetful in my old age, but that I was really, really curious to see how Tim Sale's style would adapt to Superman, because when I read Long Halloween, I thought this is the perfect fit. And I couldn't imagine how Superman would work in that sort of visual context. But I picked it up and you've got this lovely sort of like sun-dappled...
very, very Norman Rockwellian.
Very Rockwellian, yeah. Very sort of like those Smallville scenes of Superman 78. And I started flicking through that and I thought, oh yeah, this is exactly it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really, 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 really enjoy that book.
I'll be honest, I almost pick up everything Tim Sale does because I love him that much. I love all the Marvel stuff they did as well. Hulk Grey, Spider-Man Blue, Daredevil Yellow is excellent.
Did you read Captain America White?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, really
It took
good.
A long, long... It was a long time coming.
Yeah,
right?
It was.
There was
a lot of delays because they partially brought it out and then they kind of stopped for a long time, then re-released it and then finished it off. But no, it was fun. It was good. It was everything I expect from a Tim Sale, Jeff Loeb team up. I also really like Darwin Cook and Tim Sale's Superman Kryptonite.
Yep.
Excellent book.
Yeah, yeah. And I really loved in that story how, this is the tangent of all tangents, but I really loved how that's very much a Superman year two story in that, like, he doesn't know he's invulnerable. He's still getting to grips with his powers. And, you know, every time he throws himself in front of something to save someone, this could be the thing that kills him. I remember there was a really, really intense scene of him flying into an active volcano and he comes out and he's like vomiting lava. And I was like, holy shit. Yeah. It's not often you see Superman doing something that makes you think, oh, is he going to be all right?
Yeah. But I think that speaks to Superman as well. Even though it's quite in a way it's quite dark, his thought process in that book. It's quite kind of fatalistic and kind of, you know, morbid, if you will. But he still does it.
Yeah,
like he still goes through it. He doesn't go, ooh, you know, he's still, you know, full speed at the problem and he's going to fix it regardless because that's who he is and what he does.
I can only do this if I know my limits, regardless of, you know, my own personal peril.
Exactly, yeah. And again, he needs to know his limits because, you know, what if he comes into something that he thinks he can tackle and save people and he doesn't? I read a book recently, one of the Elseworlds titles, called Act of God. And it's this black lightning event that takes away all the superhero's powers.
Okay.
And Superman's trying to stop a flood and loses his powers. And that's it. This whole town gets kind of wiped away. He almost dies, and then all the people are stop having a go at him, saying, "Why don't you save everybody? What have you done?"
Yeah,
you know. And it's like he's like, "I don't know," and he goes into this like huge depression. It's not that great a book, I'll be honest. But I did find that quite some elements of it are quite interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept.
So it's definitely a cool, an interesting Elseworld. So that's what I talked about with Dennis, is like, even if there's a bad Elseworld, the idea behind it's usually quite good.
Yeah.
So get back to Long Halloween.
Yeah, shall we? Shall we fleetingly return to the thing we're supposed to be talking about in this podcast?
How do you think, again, avoiding spoilers, but how do you think that the kind of mystery element and the detective element is handled? Do you think the book keeps you guessing all the way through?
Yeah, it does. I think it does a good job of throwing red herrings your way. And that's not the only red herring as well. I quite like how there's a cute little bit right at the start in the first couple of issues where Jim Gordon thinks that Harvey Dent might be Batman because he's got that weight set in his room, and he's like, "Oh, these are really heavy."
He's got the chiseled jaw.
Yeah, that was kind of charming. I think it does a really good job of keeping you guessing, and I think they do the classic murder mystery thing of, just as you think it's going to be someone, that someone gets killed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
which stuff I really like enjoy.
Yeah, the every clue and stuff. What I also like about the book is I quite like it when monthly books are set months apart, like a month apart, like time wise. Now a lot of the times you're very much like, you know, show don't tell. You know, in most situations, you're like, with these kind of stories, you're like, show me that. Don't. But I think what's great about this is you feel that time has passed and things have moved on.
Yeah.
But you've not seen the kind of interim within the month. However, you also don't feel shortchanged by that. You've missed anything.
Yeah. That, you know what? I've never really thought about it until but it does give the story a little bit of time to breathe. And I think that works really, really well. And the characters and relationships feel a little bit more lived in for it. And even though this is a very sort of year two Gotham, it's really hard to describe it. You just get an intangible kind of feel for it. And every time I come back to this book, it's that same sort of feel. And that's what excited me about the teaser trailer for the Batman is.
Yeah.
It's this very sort of indefinable but very, very Batman feel. Oh, it's such a good book. If you've not read it, read it. If you have read it, you've probably forgotten how good it is, and you really need to come back to it.
I definitely had forgotten how good it was. Absolutely. I recently did a podcast for Comics in Motion with Max Byrne, Mandatory Marvel and DC, invited me to talk about a mandatory Marvel book, and I chose The Death and Life and Death of Captain Marvel. And as much fun as I enjoyed reading that, it was a bit of a slog.
Okay.
Like, there were moments where I'm like, okay, yeah, there's not much humor in this. Okay, I've read that sentence. You said that last issue. You know, it's kind of that. But it was an early work from Jim Starlin, and it was kind of, you know, it was very 70s. It was very, you know, of its era.
It was that thing where it was people on deadlines doing monthly. It's like those, and it's got a sort of like raw energy, like those early sort of Frank Miller issues of Daredevil.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can tell when you're reading them, like, you can tell what was written as a one shot, you know, in an ivory tower somewhere, where they had time to like prepare and time to sort of like think about the story, and what was like, right, shit, okay, how do we get characters ready to cut to point B in this issue so they can be at point C in next issue? And as satisfying as those one shots are, it's nice to, there's a kind of like scrappy energy to those, to the stories of that era that I really appreciate.
Yeah, it's so kind of, I mean, there was a lot of drama, and there was a lot of like Max said on the podcast, he said that, you know, every sentence ends with an exclamation point. It's all very dramatic, and everything's very like intense, and it can feel kind of exhausting. But when I read this, I was like, within minutes, I was halfway through it.
Yeah, it's a real page turner.
It's a real breeze. It's just so easy. And again, like he, Jeff Loeb's really good at letting the art do the talking.
Yeah.
You don't need all this exposition, like, this is what happened last issue. This is how Batman's origin, you know, came about. You know, it's just like, last month, somebody got murdered. I'm trying to figure out who the murderer is.
Yeah.
It's been going on for a year. I'm still trying to figure it out. Like, that's it. That's all you need to kind of know. And like I said, it's just like, whoom, whoom, whoom. And again, it's not balloons and balloons and balloons of text. And I got through it in less than a day, and it was just a dream to read after reading something like that.
Yeah.
Where I was like, I've got to get this done. I've got to read this before the podcast. Like, this is just like, this has been like an absolute just beautiful book. Like, one of the best books out there for Batman comics, DC in general. Like Dan said, go out and read it if you haven't reread it. But yeah, it's an absolute dream.
I think one of the things Jeff Loeb does really, really well is sort of Batman's inner monologue. Because I can't remember if there was a, I don't know if there was a particular point where they sort of started to issue the thought bubbles, or whether that's, because that's, in my head, that's always been more of a Marvel thing anyway, with the thought bubbles. Like, that is a very Spider-Man thing for me. For some reason, I always imagine like Spider-Man swinging around having thoughts with thought bubbles.
Like the electric company, when he used to speak through thought bubbles.
Yeah. And, but whereas like Batman to me has always been like, his internal monologue is communicated through the little boxes, you know, in the panels. And I think Jeff Loeb has a really good sort of a knack for writing Batman's inner monologue, because he is very good at, and as a writer myself who struggles with brevity, he is very good at saying a lot with a little. And I think if you're doing Batman's inner monologue, you kind of have to do that. He's very economical with it, but he also imbues it with a lot of character, a lot of wit. And it's one of those things that that you don't necessarily notice because you're propelled by the story. But when you keep coming back to it, it is one of those books that keeps on giving, because like, you keep coming back to it. You keep finding something new every time you read it. And what I love about it is you can breeze through it in an afternoon. But at the same time, if you go back and you take your time and you really savor the artwork, it'll just speak to you in a different way, and you'll sort of like you'll hear the rain and that's pattering down onto the sidewalk in your head. You'll like you'll smell the smoke that's coming up from the sidewalks. You know, it's a really sort of immersive version of Gotham, which you don't always get. I think I don't know whether it's a digital versus paper thing, but I find that. Or I just have less time these days, but I find that when I read comics now, I kind of race through them a bit more, and it's probably because I've got like over 1,000 issues that I've not got through to yet. And
same
shit I bought in like 2016. I thought, oh, I really must read this before like Batman v Superman comes out. You know, I've got the entirety of Peter David's run on Aquaman, which I wanted to get read before Aquaman came out. I've got all of Ta-Nehisi Coates.
The Black Panther.
Yeah, I've got all of his run on Black Panther, which I wanted to read before Black Panther came out. And I don't know whether I'm just racing through because of that, or because I'm reading them on an iPad rather than in a physical book. But for some reason, there's something magnetic about the art that just leaves me lingering on the page a little bit longer with this. Yeah. And it like I said before, it really is one of those books that just keeps on giving you. Every time, no matter how many times you read it, you'll always find something new. And I've been reading this for over 20 years now. It always gives me something new. It's not that bad.
It's
in resellable condition.
Absolutely. Yeah, you could sell that. Definitely.
I'm not bagged and boarded it.
I think my drama teacher always said that, you know, the sign of a good script is that it's a mess, like it's in pieces.
Yeah.
I think it's the same with the sign of a good book. You know, read it front to back, and it is going to get wear and tear, but it just shows you how much love you have for that story and that writing. So I think that's the same with me. The first few Spider-Man books I had, split right down the seam, so all the pages are coming out and stuff, and it was like a proper graphic novel. And I was like, back in the day, I was like, I'm going to read this.
Yeah,
I was like, oh god.
Well, funny you should mention that, because actually the cover has come off this. I think I've super glued it since, so it's pretty secure now. But yeah, I remember I literally kept turning the pages so much, and because it's got these really luscious
full
page spreads,
you want to
yank it open and see everything. So
I was kind of hoping. Now I know in year one with. Now, I have no idea why Frank Miller decided to name Jim Gordon's wife Barbara
to add more confusion to everything. But I really liked the kind of struggling marriage in year one, and the kind of the affair with is it Essen?
Sarah Essen,
who later comes back into the continuity as well, much later. I quite like that kind of story, along with the kind of more fantastical elements of year one.
Yeah, and it'll always be a crime that René Russo never got to play that character.
Oh, yeah.
I remember when I first read that book, I thought, oh, if they do this, because I remember, because René Russo was supposed to be Chase Meridian when Michael Keaton was doing Batman Forever. Yeah, and then when they recast Val Kilmer, they thought, we need to go with someone a bit younger, so they went with Nicole Kidman. But I remember thinking, yeah, René Russo would really, really crush it as Sarah Essen. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, that'd be a great character to see as well, because I think within the Batman world, it's chock full of brim with kind of father figures.
Yeah.
And I think it would be nice to see more kind of mother figures. Like, I'd love to see like Leslie Tompkins in a movie, yeah, in a really juicy role, or someone like Sarah Essen or somebody else kind of similar to that. I know they've kind of made appearances in Gotham and stuff, but I would like to see them in the proper classic context of a Batman story and be the right ages and stuff. You know, have maybe a little romance with Alfred, maybe.
I think Scott Snyder did quite a lot of stuff with Martha Wayne towards the end of his run on Batman. It could be Tom King, I could be misremembering, but I know they've sort of made more of an effort to sort of flesh out Martha Wayne a little bit in recent years, because I whenever you think of like Batman's parenthood, you inevitably think of Thomas Wayne. And I think they are making efforts to sort of redress that a little bit.
Yeah, it's just like the pearl necklace.
Yeah,
that's about it. You kind of go, but Martha Wayne, pearl necklace. That's kind of all you kind of know. Now I didn't mean for that to sound as dirty as it sounds.
Well, I was going to say, now when you think of Martha Wayne, you think, why did you say that name?
Yeah, I actually do. Yeah, I do think Martha.
I will defend with my dying breath, by the way.
I'm sure you will.
And will on this podcast.
Oh,
as
yes.
Well.
Oh, yes.
I haven't forgotten that we need to have a lengthy conversation.
Oh,
about
I know. We'll have it soon. Sooner than you think. Who knows?
Okay.
We'll see. But what I was saying was, I kind of wished we'd had a bit more kind of tension within the Gordon marriage.
Yeah.
Because that was quite a pivotal moment in that original story, year one.
Mm-hmm.
But in this, it's kind of like, obviously, I mean, you kind of get a Harvey and Gilda having their issues.
Yeah.
Which kind of, I guess, kind of replaced that. But maybe just a little callback or a little nudge or, I remember when you did this, or do you remember when you did that? Or like, there's still like a little bit of resentment there or something. I could have done with just something like that. Because it's not the perfect marriage, I don't think. And it will end.
Yeah.
Continuity-wise, we know it ends. We know that Jim and his son, Barbara and the son, James Gordon Jr., go off and live somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then in continuity, and I think it's I think Black Mirror, Scott, he comes back.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
James Gordon Jr. comes back in a very disturbing manner.
Oh, that's such a good book as well.
Yeah, really good. That's kind of an early Scott Snyder story. It's because it's Dick Grayson as Batman as well, which makes him quite unique. But that's a really good story. Also, I had another question in this continuity.
Yeah.
Is Barbara Gordon, the daughter, is she a blood relative of Jim, or is she adopted?
I think, I could be wrong, but doesn't Barbara say that that Batgirl Barbara is his niece?
Possibly. There's a mention in the book of Babs and a cousin or something.
See, I don't, because there's, like, when I was reading through it most recently, like, there were things that I kept expecting to happen which are actually in Dark Victory, the sequel.
Yeah, I think I was the same, yeah.
Although, while I'm talking about that, this book really manages to cram a lot of story in. I know it's 12 issues, so it's longer than you usually get, but it manages to cram a lot of story in. But at the same time, everything feels absolutely perfectly paced, and I think the moments that need to breathe do get to breathe, which is difficult in comics when you think about it. When it's really difficult to control the reader's pace.
Absolutely.
And I think this book does that masterfully.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with that. I think, like we're saying about the kind of the time between the months and the passing of that, I think that also allows the book to breathe, but then also makes you want to read it quicker and kind of devour it quicker as well.
Yeah.
Also at the same time, while even when I read it this time, like you said, you want to hold on those pages and look at them. I would go back.
Yeah.
You know, because I go, you know what?
I want to look at that again. I want to see that again. I want to read that again. Really take that in.
I think I definitely. I'm assuming there's an absolute edition of this somewhere.
Oh, probably.
I definitely want to pick up.
I think there's a black and white edition as well.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Kind of a noir Batman noir thing.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of black and white sort of sequences, and they do the sort of Schindler's List thing where you have the little splashes of color where you need them the most, and it would be a bit of a spoiler to talk about when and how they're used, but they're used very, very powerfully, and it's just such a good book. I can try and articulate it as much as possible, but there's really no substitute for sort of reading it for yourself.
No, exactly. I respect this book so much that I think we've danced around it, and again, you know, there's probably a million podcasts about it everywhere.
Oh yeah, yeah,
and there's
definitely
articles and lists and various other things. So we would be retreading old ground to talk about it, you know, beat by beat and stuff like that. I feel like, as again, like the resolution to it is really earned.
Yeah,
like
it's
really earned, and it really ramps up as well. The last couple of issues, it really does like really like take that like tension, everything that's been building up over this long Halloween, you know, comes to a real satisfying conclusion.
Yeah.
And the kind of reveal of the culprit, he or she, you know, is interesting. And then there's also still a little room for doubt as well.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm probably quite thick anyway, so I'm quite easily surprised, but What I liked about it was the story's so immersive and the art is so immersive that you kind of forget that it's a whodunit, because you could very easily like be flicking through thinking, I think it's this person, I think it's that person. And you do that, but only when the book wants you to, I think. Mm. You question who the killer might be when the book sort of prompts you to, but I think generally you're too immersed in the story to really think about it all that much, so that when the reveal does come, it's surprising enough for you, and it has the heft that it should, in a way that I think if you spent all your time trying to guess who it was, it wouldn't be quite as satisfying.
No, and again, like you said, there's a lot of red herrings, so you can never really, like, the characters are never really sure, and you're never really sure. So I there's so many, like, yeah, like you said, oh, it could be this person. Oh, no, they're dead. It could be this person. No, they're dead. You know, it's kind of, there's fun to that. And again, it's like, it's a large element to the story, yet you could, you know, like you said, it could just be, you know, just a year in Batman's life and him just tackling all these villains. You get that element, but then you also get that other level of the mystery.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think the best Batman stories, like Under the Red Hood, Hush, you know, Long Halloween, there is a mystery element. There's something that kind of a deeper connection to Batman, his characters, his past, that are, you know, no matter how you feel about the characters or the reveals or the villains themselves, I think there's always something to be mined there.
Yeah.
I'd say that the detective work is not, I don't think there's much detective work, I'd say, in this.
No.
I'd say more it's kind of him chasing down leads.
Yeah, yeah.
More so than him, like, studying the crime scene and things like that. Because I think that might have slowed down the book, I think, if there was a lot of the kind of, like, hey, there was this, and there was this DNA, and there was that, and there was the fingerprints, and there's, you know, you don't really need to know that. You know the main kind of the gun, the silencer, the little holiday treat that he leaves, the calling card, and that's all you kind of need to know. But he is kind of, he's in interrogating, you know, strong-arming people, you know, kidnapping people and tricking them with false masks and disguises, that sort of thing. But I always enjoy a Batman mystery.
And
I think it plays to the world's greatest detective sensibilities of the character as well.
And it's not very often where Batman gets to be one step behind.
Yeah.
I think especially in sort of like the post sort of, I think, early noughties, we went into the sort of Bat God era where he became sort of infallible. He was always the smartest man in the room. He was always the best martial artist in the room.
It's like any question, like Batman versus anybody. Oh, Batman wins.
Yeah.
You know,
how much prep time does he get? Yeah. but whereas I quite like how the book manages to keep him guessing, and he always manages to get into the right place at just the wrong time.
Yeah.
But it's never at the expense of, you never start to doubt like how smart Batman is or like how capable he is as a detective. It's all perfectly pitched. And what I wanted to just talk, like, in closing, to ask you is, like, where do you stand on Dark Victory? And do you think they caught lightning in a bottle with this book, because for me anyway, Dark Victory, even though it's doing a lot of the same stuff, it doesn't and it's still a worthy book. And still enjoy it.
It's fun.
It doesn't quite have that same intangible magic to it.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I don't think it is as good. I do like the introduction of Robin.
Yeah.
I think that's integral. I love the kind of, most people that like, I know I said I like solo Batman, but I also like the Bat Family.
Yeah.
Like the same kind of, I like those stories as well. And I'm not like, I never want to see Robin. I never want to see Batgirl. I never want to see all these other characters, because I like them in their own right. But I do believe that Long Halloween is superior. I think superior to Dark Victory is The Haunted Nights.
Yeah.
Which is by the same creative team, and it's three big kind of Halloween specials, I think, or kind of Christmas specials and or annuals or something. And I think there's their solo stories or that collection is better than Dark Victory. I think that's kind of a prequel to Long Halloween, I think, because I think they were done before. So there's some elements. I know the stuff about because there's a bit in one of the stories in Haunted Nights where Martha Wayne is reading a story to Bruce, and it's Alice in Wonderland.
Okay.
And then the main story is Barbara Gordon, daughter Barbara Gordon, gets kidnapped by the Mad Hatter.
Okay.
And he says, and he kind of links that to the villain. He's like, "You've twisted the memory of my mother." And it also in that same moment where they're like, "Right, we've got to close the book. We're going to go out now, Bruce." And he says, "Mum, can you wear the pearls?"
Okay.
And he asks her to wear the pearls. She's like, "Yeah, but this is for a special occasion. We're just going to the movies." She's like, "Please wear the pearls." And he asks her to wear the pearls. And then obviously that becomes a very famous element of the death. So you've always seen the pearls. So it almost twists the Mad Hatter into a minor, sillier Batman villain into quite a kind of a heart-wrenching reminder of, you know, his loss and the reason he became Batman.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really nice story. And it's referenced in Long Halloween as well. So he mentions when he sees the Mad Hatter, he's like, "I remember that. She read me that book the night she died."
Okay.
That sort of thing.
I have read Haunted Night, but I think I literally did. I know exactly when I read it. I read it when I was 16, so it would have been 98. And I was I was on work experience in a library. And on my lunch break, I could just like get whatever I wanted to read. And I remember seeing...
Sounds like a good job.
I thought, this Batman book looks good. And I remember just taking up and like, I had an hour-long lunch break, so it was golden. So I think I got through it in an hour or two.
If I remember rightly, it's a Mad Hatter story, a Penguin story, and then a kind of a Christmas Carol type story.
Yeah.
I think the Penguin one, he kind of links to his kind of elitism and kind of like because the Oswald the Cobblepots and the Waynes are like friends, and I think in that issue or that annual he hires Lucius Fox because he's like, "I need someone to run my company the way it should be run and not, you know, like on one of these, you know, corporate fat cats." So he hires him and he says, you know, because he met him like years ago in France when he was like studying martial arts and stuff, and he's like, "You're Bruce Wayne," and you know, he's like, "Yeah, I'm not interested in Wayne Enterprises, just leave it alone." And then he's like, "Yeah, but we can do so much with your company. We can help so many people." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm more interested in just punching people at the moment." So that's quite a nice issue as well, even though I don't like the design of the Penguin.
For some reason, Haunted Night has been one of those books that I keep seeing it on the shelf and thinking, "Oh, I'll pick that up at some point because I've got you know, the Long Halloween and Dark Victory." And so Long Halloween's got like a blue spine, Dark Victory's got a red spine, and I believe Haunted Night's got an orange spine.
Yeah, I think it's orange, yeah.
So, and I think they look all really good together on my shelf. But for some reason, I just never got around to picking it up. But I will pick it up, and I'm going to pick up a physical copy as well.
Yeah, do it.
I think it's just one of those stories. I think Tim Sale's art is just better enjoyed on paper than
I would pick up. I honestly would pick up all the Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale stuff, especially Dead or Yellow is one of my favourites.
Because
it kind of reframes the kind of sillier, you know, weirder kind of early kind of Scarlet Swashbuckler era.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of links it to kind of modern day and the death of Karen Page. I know we're big fans of Daredevil.
It's very sweet as well. It's a very sweet love story between Matt Murdock and Karen Page. And I think the characterization and the way she's drawn are very, very winsome. In the same way that Deborah Ann Woll's performance is very, very, like, you instantly like this character. Yeah. And obviously she's in a very sympathetic situation in that show, but, like, you at no point do you stop liking Karen Page, like, through the highs and lows. And I think the book does the same thing.
Absolutely. And they're really good. The Marvel ones are really good because they're framed as letters to people that have died.
Yes.
So for Daredevil, it's Karen Page. For Spider-Man, it's Gwen Stacy. For the Hulk, it's Betty Banner. And I think Captain America White is to Bucky.
Yeah, I think it is Bucky, yeah.
So all of those characters are very integral to those stories as well, and that's why they're kind of writing to them or recording a message to them. There's a really sweet moment in Spider-Man Blue where Mary Jane comes in while he's still recording.
I was just thinking about that moment, yeah.
And she says, yeah, and she's married to Peter at the time, so they're still married. He's recording this. He's like, you know, this is the anniversary or your birthday or of your death. I can't remember. And she's like, oh, you're okay. You're saying hello to Gwen. Say hello from me.
Yeah.
Because they were friends.
Yeah. She says, tell her I miss her too.
Yeah.
And that really, like, ugh. Because it's like it's so easy to play that off as a rival, like a love triangle or a rivalry. Yeah. But, like, no, they're friends.
Yeah, of course. And they were, you know, there was rivals to some degree. But the MJ Spider-Man relationship has always been very up and down, very hot and cold throughout all of his history.
In and out of continuity.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me started. But yeah, I think we're kind of slowly coming to the end of this one.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. I think, you know, I'm sure it's been recommended forever, but we love it. It's a big favourite of ours.
And on the subject of continuity, one last thing I want to say is, like, it's one of those books that benefits from being completely outside of continuity. Like, you can...
Yeah.
There's something that happens in it which has implications for continuity.
Yeah.
But it can fit really wherever you want it to. It's as canonical as you want it to be, really.
And again, it's somewhat of an origin story, like we were saying earlier, to the transformation of Gotham from the pinstripe mobsters to the freaks of the asylum type thing. And more. But again, don't want to spoil that.
Yeah.
But I think pick it up if you've not read it. Like you said, reread it. Read it again.
There's nothing you have to have read to understand it, which is so rare in comics, especially in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, and I think if you are not a comic book reader per se, and you're not, you know, fully versed in all the kind of, you know, continuity errors and changes and, you know, crises on several Earths, you can just, you know, anybody can pick this
up. It's really accessible.
I mean, it reminds me of those kind of those 90s books that were like Marvel's Kingdom Come that were kind of coffee table books.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this does have that feel. And I think that's to its strength as well.
Definitely.
But there are elements you'll be like, I don't really know that character, or I'm not really sure. But you'll recognize the Penguin, the, you know, the Scarecrow, you know, things from the films. I forgot to mention it really, but it's got a heavy, heavy influence on The Dark Knight, Chris Nolan's Dark Knight.
Oh yeah, big time.
You know, and that's one of the best Batman movies ever, if not the best. And I think there's a lot of that in this. There's even I Believe in Harvey Dent.
Of course, that's where it comes from.
That, you know, that comes from that book, and he does genuinely believe that Harvey, he wants to help Harvey and make Harvey the best he can be. And he, you know, I think Gordon says he was the best of all of us as well. I think something like that. I think he says.
And there's even a line in this book where Batman sort of like implies that his mission is finite. You know, I think it's like, I think it's New Year's Eve. He basically says like, oh, I'm 1 year closer to this being over. Like, and it's really interesting when you're in that sort of year two era to think, this wasn't always the never ending battle. You know, I know that's a Superman thing, but
yeah.
this was meant to be a finite thing.
Mm. Yeah. Like he wanted to solve crime. He wants to stop all crime. And he even says in the book, he's like, I'm that close.
Yeah.
I'm that close. He thinks that with the fall of the Roman Empire, that'll do it. That'll just, you know, that's one massive chunk. That's one massive goal I've achieved. And again, he talks about the promise.
Yeah.
Like in the opening, like even I think the first opening pages, there's a quote, the quote marks, like the first five or six pages are the quotes of him going, I promise my parents I will end crime.
Yeah.
I'll do this. And then, you know, it's the first few pages he says that line as well. And I think that's very important. And again, plays throughout the book. I mean, I'm just trying to think of any other kind of moments. There's some great Catwoman stuff in here as well.
There is some great Catwoman and some great Selina Kyle stuff as well.
Yes. Yeah. I think Selina Kyle has never looked as gorgeous.
And there is a spin-off as well in this sort of this little sort of continuity, subcontinuity, Catwoman When in Rome, which is a whole other podcast, but it's definitely worth checking out.
I almost included it on my top five Riddler stories.
Okay, it is a good Riddler story.
It is a very good Riddler story. It's a great Catwoman story, and it does have a lot to... I think it's set between Long Halloween and Dark Victory, I believe.
Yes, it is,
I think so. And you kind of understand what she's doing in this book. It kind of gives... It changes your perspective on why she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah.
And you lent it to me and I read it. I loved it. So thank you very much for letting me have that.
My pleasure.
But yeah, is there anything else you would like to say about Batman and the Longest of the Long Halloweens?
It's everything you want in a Batman story.
Perfect. I can't disagree with you at all. I'd love to tear your argument to shreds, but I can't. It is exactly what you want from Batman in general. Again, heavily influencing two major Batman films, you know, and more, no doubt.
And we've got an animated adaptation on the way.
Exactly. I can't wait for that. Maybe we could review that.
I'd be delighted to, yeah.
We'll have to have that. I think it's in two parts as well, which I think I prefer with these bigger stories that split it, like Dark Knight Returns.
Definitely, yeah.
I'm glad they decided to split it. I think they probably should have done that with Hush as well, and maybe a couple of the other stories, but that's my opinion. So, Dan, you are on the social medias, aren't you?
I am, yeah. You can find me on the Twitter, at DLKeatis. That's K-E-A-T-I-S. I try to be nice, even though Twitter makes it difficult sometimes. But I'm also on Instagram, the same at. I post on there very, very irregularly. But if you like pictures of hot toys, poorly taken, with an over-reliance on filters, you might enjoy them.
There you go. Well, as always, you can find the podcast on Facebook at Secret Boars. Twitter, it's at Dan_Boars. Instagram, Spider Dan Secret Boars. And the podcast is available on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and previews are available on YouTube and many, many more places. And if you'd like to donate towards the podcast, you can buy me a coffee at ko-fi.com/SpiderDan and the Secret Boars. And if you are going to interact with us, don't forget to use the hashtag #PrepareForPrattle. Thanks for joining us this Shock Phobia Fest. I hope you've enjoyed all the range of interesting delights, horror delights that we brought to you. Thank you again for joining me, Dan. This has been excellent.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll see you next year. No, we'll see you next month. All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.